Hi, welcome to Project Geospatial. I'm Adam Simmons here at GeoInt 2023 here in St. Louis, Missouri, and I am back, happy to have Tom Ager on with us. Tom is a radar expert in the industry. I can't even undersell that. He's amazing in the industry. He knows a lot, and probably no one in the industry knows more about the radar industry more than him right now. So I'm
making me uncomfortable. Those things are not true, but go ahead.
Okay, well, how about you you talk about yourself a little bit, and we'll go from there and dive right into the topic of finding out a little bit more about the status of the entire community.
All right, so Tom Ager, people misunderstand how much I know about SAR. I'm actually trained as a photogrammetrist and geodesist. That's what I learned in graduate school, and that's what I did in the first half of my career at NGA. Halfway through, I picked up a SAR project, and it changed my career. I began to love SAR, and I'm actually self-taught on SAR. I became the SAR program manager in NGA, and so I got this unearned reputation of being an expert. Certainly, I know a lot about it, but I worked with brilliant people who are the real SAR scientists, people like Jack Jakowicz from Sandia, for example, and other wonderful people who helped me. So I was a program... I always called myself a technically skilled program manager. And one thing I tried to do all through my career is teach things, technical things, to my coworkers. I did that for photogrammetry and geodesy, and I did it later for SAR. And recently, after I left, I wrote a book on SAR, which Adam interviewed me about. But that book is for normal professionals, not electrical engineers. But I do have a big view of how things work for SAR and what the industry is like. Yeah.
You're helping define SAR to everybody else, and that's great. We need that translation between the two media.
Yes, because SAR is inherently odd, and it was developed by brilliant electrical engineers who speak in a language most of us can't understand. And so it has its electrical engineering heritage and a weirdness, which are two challenges, and I try to make it look beautiful because it is beautiful, and you can understand it without having to know all of the advanced mathematics. That's what I'm trying to do.
That's great. So diving into the topic of this discussion with you today, we want to learn more about your thoughts on the SAR industry as it is now, and perhaps where it's going here in the future.
Yeah, so the revolution in SAR, well, a little over a decade ago, we had the wonderful emergence of TerraSARx, Cosmos SkyMed, and RadarSat-2, very capable, unclassified SAR spacecraft. But those systems, and it was very exciting to see that happen, and I was involved in trying to promote them. Unfortunately, their international systems in the United States didn't have an interest in purchasing the data very much, although NGA did access the WorldDEM produced by the TerraSARx and TandemX system. But those systems are partly government-funded. They're pseudo-commercial. Since then, we've had fully commercial SAR systems developed with venture capital money, and that is, in the United States, Capella, ISAI, and Umbra. They're all here at GeoInt. And the international version of ISAI in Finland, and Japanese systems since Synspective. And so that is a real revolution, because these are little tiny SARs compared to the giant ones. A lot of people thought it could never work. Well, it's working. And I like to say those guys are operating at the intersection of user need and what physics and economics will allow. So it makes them be very flexible, customer focused, and not try to do everything. They're doing things without trying to bend physics, and they're constrained by having to make money. So they're doing small satellites, and they're revolutionizing remote sensing in that way.
So talking about how things are now, what are you seeing at this conference in terms of the different SAR providers out there? The progress we've made thus far has been incredible, right? Where we were even 10 years ago, you know, it's we've come a long way.
Yes. Okay. So these little SAR companies, well, these SAR companies are building fleets of small SARs, lots of them. And so that's a real revolution in remote sensing, because SAR is the only sensor that can guarantee you a collection. So we're going to be able to get collection anywhere in the world quickly. And the images are relatively low cost. The satellites are much cheaper, of course, and they can be built much quicker than the big systems. So if you do that, though, you lose something. You can't go to something so massive and expensive to something little without losing something. So what do you lose? One thing you lose is orbital duty cycle. That is, the number of images they can collect per orbit is very low in comparison to the big guys. They lose on lifespan. RADARSAT-1 lasted for 19 years. These little SARs, they're spec'd for 3 years, and they're probably going to last 3 years or so. And you lose on signal to noise. I'd like to address that one separately, but say for the first two, while those are impediments, sometimes impediments are opportunities. So the lack of imaging time per orbit really doesn't matter if you have a whole fleet of them, because it's what the fleet can do that matters, not how much you can do per. If you're going to have 30 satellites, you're still going to have massive collection capacity. And maybe all of these sensors, all these companies will have tens of satellites. And the lifespan, while it's limited, that can be an advantage too, because you can put up a new one relatively cheaply and quickly with new technology, right? So the lifespan, I don't care about. You can upgrade the hardware timely rather than having to wait 15 years. So signal to noise, though, is the challenge for spaceborne SARs. So why is that a challenge? So I'd like to just teach a little thing to you here so we can appreciate why is signal to noise such a problem for little SARs. So when we send a pulse out, we send thousands per second. Let's just look at one pulse. Here it goes. Going to leave the antenna. Boom. There it goes. For ISI, that pulse is 3,000 watts. Okay, so it's a nice, strong, young pulse. There it goes. It goes down to the ground, and it starts to widen as it goes to the ground. It's like inflating a balloon. And when you inflate a balloon, what happens to the skin? It gets thin.
Yeah.
So the power density of this pulse weakens with the square of the distance. It's got to go like 700 kilometers. It hits something on the ground. Only a portion of it reflects. And as it comes back, it weakens again with the square of the distance. So you've got this really weak return coming back to a small antenna. It can only capture a little bit of that return. So if the pulse left at 3,000 watts, what would you guess is the strength of it when it hits the antenna?
Oh, I'm guessing an exponentially decreased form of that.
Would you say 100 watts, 10 watts? It's 10 to the negative 17 watts.
Wow.
Yes. See, since I'm an outsider, when I learned these things, I was astounded. Electrical engineer would say, well, what do you expect?
Yeah.
So when I first saw that, calculated, I made a mistake. I did it again. 10 to the 17 watts. I got it again. I did another form of the equation. Same answer. Showed it to somebody. Oh, yeah, that's how it works. So this thing that comes back is so enfeebled. It's so weak. Any noise is a challenge for it, right? Well, what's noise on SAR? Well, noise is any microwave hitting that antenna that's not that signal. So where would other microwaves be coming from? Why would other microwaves hit the antenna? Well, one source is wonderful. You know it. You've heard of it. It's called the cosmic background microwave radiation.
Oh, yeah.
From the Big Bang. Those are microwaves, and they've been traveling across the universe for 13 billion years, and some of them smack into the antenna. So some of the dots you see in a SAR image are signals from the Big Bang. I think that's fantastic.
That's awesome.
How wonderful is that?
Now,
that's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably a whole separate science could be focused on that alone.
So the system can't distinguish them from the real microwaves, from the signals. They're the same. But that's not the main source of noise on SAR. The fundamental principle of remote sensing is that all objects above absolute zero emit electromagnetic radiation. The recorder on the sensor, the receiver, it operates at a temperature. So it emits microwaves. So I like to call this the poignant story of signals and noise. Because the receiver itself creates microwaves that confuse it.
Yeah.
Right? So it's creating microwaves that it thinks are the reflected signal. So it does it to itself, and we can't stop it unless we can put up receivers that operate at absolute zero. That's not going to happen. So this is called thermal noise. So noise is always going to occur on a SAR image. And what you need for that is a strong pulse. That 3,000 watt thing from ISA, that's pretty strong. But you need a big antenna. These are little SARs. They don't have big antennas, right? So that's their challenge. So the signal to noise ratio for these little guys isn't as good as it is for the real big guys. And that's one of the things you give up. One thing you don't give up, resolution. And that's astonishing. Why? Well, there's two aspects to resolution on SAR. You would think, well, it's a little SAR, it can't operate so good, my resolution's going to be limited. That's not true. One is azimuth. When you fly this way, you look off to the side. All right, so I'm flying into the camera. I look off to the side. This direction, the flight direction, is called azimuth. And the longer you image in that direction, the better the azimuth resolution. So I'm sending pulses up, and I'm staring at something. It's called spotlight mode. It's like sending my energy all to the same point on the ground like a spotlight. And in this forum, just this week, ISAI, and I'm not trying to promote ISAI. The other guys are going to do this too, okay? They just announced a form of spotlight imaging they call Dwell. Why do they call it Dwell? Because they're imaging this spot on the ground for 25 seconds.
Wow, okay.
Okay, so what's that mean? Satellites flying at 7.5 kilometers per second for 25 seconds, that means it's traveled almost 190 kilometers during that collect. So the synthetic aperture length is 190 kilometers. It is as if you have an antenna in space 190 kilometers long. What do you think the resolution in azimuth is for that collect? I'm interviewing you.
Oh, boy.
It's real below a meter. It's 5 centimeters.
5 centimeters. I was going to say below 15 centimeters, so I would have been on the right.
Centimeters, people.
Yeah.
Whoa. Now, range is the other dimension. And range, the resolution in the range is a function of how much we chirp the pulse. That is, we send a pulse out, but we vary the frequency of the pulse, like a bird's chirp. That right now is like 300 million cycles per second or so, and that will give you on the ground roughly a meter. Soon it will be 600, so that's going to be half a meter. Then it's going to go to 1,200 megahertz. That's a quarter meter on the ground.
So talk about the use cases for this type of capability that we're now seeing.
Okay, before I get to that, I want to make this point about resolution.
Okay.
The resolution of the little baby SARs will be those numbers I just mentioned within 2 years.
Good.
That's crazy. And it won't really get better than that, even 10 or 20 years from now, because once you make your aperture length that long, to make it longer imposes collection and processing burdens, which are difficult to deal with. And 5 centimeters is pretty freaking good anyway, right?
Yeah.
The other one in range is limited by the International Telecommunications Union, which says you can't have a pulse bandwidth bigger than 1,200 megahertz because it interferes with other signals like 5G. They're not going to let that happen. So 5 centimeters in azimuth, a quarter meter in range within 2 years. That's shocking.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe. And a challenge for the United States is this is what technology allows to happen at low cost. Are we going to constrain that by licenses? We do now. But I like to think of it this way. We invented SAR. That was done Goodyear Aerospace, 1950s, Carl Wiley. We invented it. That's our daughter. She left home. She traveled the world. She speaks German, Italian, Spanish, Finnish, Japanese. And if we tell her to come home at midnight, she's not going to do it, right? So we don't control it anymore. And internationally, what I just said is going to happen. Already happening today, you saw. So this is a question for us. What can we do? And I think it's out of our control, at least internationally. So the use cases for this is, of course, people love resolution and people are going to be asking for high resolution. And that's what, of course, some other people want wide area coverage. We can do that too, to find ships at sea and things like that, to look at changing ice fields. You don't need high resolution for that. And people care about those things a lot. But mostly it will be high resolution. And it's getting done now by the little SARs. Where? In the Ukraine-Russia conflict. See how valuable unclassified, shareable, guaranteed collection in bad weather is being done by the Ukrainians all the time to see Russian mechanized equipment where it is.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want to learn how to use SAR, when this is over, I'd go talk to the Ukrainians because they know. Right. That's a use case.
Awesome. Amazing.
Yeah.
So in terms of what you see the current status of the companies that exist right now, there's a lot of companies that are SAR that are there,
yeah,
that have emerged in recent years. You feel like the collaborations is a lot better than it was 10 years ago, or do you feel like we're moving in the right direction that SAR is now starting to become more integrated, commercial SAR is more integrated into the U.S. government?
Well, when TerraSAR, Cosmo, RadarSat-2 were all launched, there was a COMSAR working group, USGIF, managed it. I was involved. And those companies, all competitors, all collaborated on things of mutual interest.
Yes, they did.
That's not happening now. And I think all those companies would benefit if that happened now. Because there are a few things they all care about which would benefit all of them. Like, how do you evaluate the quality of an image? Right now in the government, we do that with analysts reviewing scores of images manually, very slowly. I think that that can be automated with calibrated data, and you can come up with a new way to do that that's more precise and much faster, right? That would benefit the government and these companies, and I think that's something we all need to discuss. I've been talking to them a little bit about it, and I hope that that happens. That's a collaboration that will help everybody.
Well, a next topic is with the amount of data we're going to be getting here. Well, even now with the amount of SAR out there, there's a lot of talk about the integration of AI and ML for quite some time.
Yes.
So can you talk about your thoughts about that topic?
Yeah, I can. First of all, I'm no expert on AI and ML. It is, of course, really important. And we see things that now are shocking us with ChatGPT and all of that. It's unbelievable. And people are pursuing that. You see it all through this conference. People throw the terms around a lot. And some of that's going to work in the near term for SAR. We need it to work. Things like detecting a ship. SAR is good at seeing big metal things. That's a big metal thing, usually on a dark background, the ocean. So detecting ships in ports and at sea, I think AI and ML is going to be very good at that in the near term. But there's other things that are really difficult for it. Find me and identify a T-72 tank. Well, the background for that is not the ocean, it's the ground, so there's more clutter around the object. The signal for the object varies depending on which way it's facing, which way the energy came, which way the turret is pointing. So for a software to know what that is and say, it would need a million different images of it. And that's just 1 feature.
Large, more training data sets than it would take for the normal electro-optical.
Yes, yes. And I know this company's here making simulated data. That's the way to go because you're not going to have collections. Well, but
it'd be expensive.
Really hard,
yeah,
to do. That's all. And I think it's getting oversold a little bit. Of course, we got to pursue it. I'm enthusiastic about it. But I think we talk about it with a little bit too much optimism. To achieve anything in science, you need 2 engines, openness and skepticism. And I think in this case, our skepticism engine needs a little bit more fuel. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
All right.
Well, is there any other points you'd like to make about the SAR industry, where it's at or where it's going as we close up our conversation today?
Yeah, I have one last point to make. So while we're going to pursue AI and ML and automated extraction of information, we have to do that. We still need people looking at SAR images and analyzing them. You know, we're going to need human beings to do that. I'm sorry, that's the case. So what do we do now for those guys? We collect all of this data. We form an image. And by the way, that image is a complex image. It's called that. It has amplitude information and phase information. Remember, SAR is a coherent collect. It's got phase. That's really, really valuable data. But for you to look at it, you can't look at a complex image. So I'm going to process that to make you a grayscale image. And when I do that, I just threw away all the phase. So the heart of SAR, its beating heart, is its coherence. I just threw that all away. You don't have it. You're going to exploit that image. Now, if you want that, you have to do a special order and get something else. We can make a really useful product from phase called the color subaperture image. And some of the little SARs are now starting to make these things. What's a color subaperture image? Well, remember, I'm collecting an azimuth for a long time. That gives me my azimuth resolution. So imagine instead of keeping the entire synthetic aperture, I just processed the first half of it. I could still make an image. It would have azimuth resolution reduced by 2, right? But I can make a second image out of the second half of the aperture. And then I have 2 images and I can overlay them. Suppose I do that with 3 of them. I split the aperture into 3 portions. I make the first one red, the second green, the third blue. If the reflections are the same, when I overlap those, they look gray. And you would see the normal grayscale image you're used to. But suppose in the first image here, there is a Russian mechanized troop transport thing right there, which in the first part of the aperture glints, strong reflection. On that thing, it's going to show up red. You're going to see it red. So SAR reflects off of things with straight lines and cubic structures. Nature doesn't build things like that. Humans do. So this color subaperture image shows colors for glints, and those tend to be human-made objects. So if you want that now, you order a regular grayscale image, and then I'm going to put in an order for a CSI image and deliver that to me, and I have this one, and maybe I pay for both of them. Whereas what we should do is the image is a complex image, right? Amplitude and phase, we need to make that easily orderable, easily exploitable. How can you do that? Well, you can output the complex image in amplitude and phase instead of, you may have heard of in phase and quadrature. What the hell is that? The real and imaginary numbers. It's crazy for SAR. Simple thing, amplitude and phase, and put it in GeoTIFF. So I can give you a complex image in GeoTIFF, and your Sokka GXP or remote view, wherever you have, will be able to read it. It doesn't even know it's a complex image. It just sees the phase as a separate layer, like in multispectral. It won't be able to do anything with it yet, but it has it. And you're going to have the full res data.
Yeah.
Not some multi-look, lower resolution thing. And then somebody's going to write an app to do something with the phase so that you can make your own color subaperture image fast. And so you could say, I'm going to look at this on, I'm going to go talk, by the way, to BAE about this today. And then the other guys, we give you a complex image in GeoTIFF. Your existing tool can read it. And then someday soon, I hope, you've got apps to mess with the phase data. Make me this, make me that. And it happens fast. So you can have the full res grayscale image, a multi-looks grayscale image with less speckle, a color subaperture image, and none of that is magic. We know how to do that. 11 years ago, we demoed in this GeoWint symposium a laptop. All we had was a laptop with a browser. All of our data was 800 miles away in Michigan. I forget where we were, Tampa or someplace. We had complex data in Michigan, and we had that laptop, and we had a server with these apps I'm talking about. And 11 years ago, we were making color subaperture image. Make me one. It would make it. Make me this. It would make it. That was 11 years ago. So I have a question for you. You're interviewing me. Do you think hardware processing muscle has improved over the last decade?
No.
Yeah. Do you think app coding has improved in 11 years?
Improved? Yes.
Yes.
I do, actually.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So we can do these things, but we'll never do it if we can't imagine it. And I think, of course, AI and ML is crucially important, but it's also important to understand the SAR image is a complex image. And to make it easily ingestible and exploitable, we can put it out in cloud-optimized GeoTIFF in amplitude and phase. That's what we should.
Well, I want to circle back to the human element where we started that conversation with. And before we end, I would like to get your thoughts on, because obviously with all this technology, all the sensors, the talent is important too. We have to have people who know how to look at this, trained in it. And what are your thoughts on basically the education? Let's ignore the technology for a second and focus on the education part of this. What's your thoughts about bringing more talent into the SAR industry?
I'm worried about technical education in America in general.
Fair.
You know? Right. So how good are we at teaching physics and mathematics to people in high school and in college? I don't think we're doing a good enough job in that. And I don't know the current staffing in these agencies. But when I was a young guy, DMA encouraged me to go to Virginia Tech to learn photogrammetry and geodesy, and they paid for it.
Yeah.
And that changed my career.
So SAR specifically, do you know about the pipelines in colleges and universities now that focus on...
I think we're losing it. I think the great, brilliant radar people I once knew are getting older like me, and I'm not one of them. I said that to begin, and retiring, and I don't believe they're getting replaced.
So you think we're struggling? A lot of the aging professionals are reaching a point where, we're going to have a lot of gaps in our knowledge base for not technology as a whole, but specifically it could be for the SAR industry, which is ironic because SAR is exploding right now. You know, it's starting to be everywhere.
Yes.
So at what point do you think we're going to be, in a critical space where now we have all this demand, it's all there, but now where's all the talent to look at it and understand it?
I can only say I think the emergence of the little SARs will help solve this problem because you're going to need people.
Yeah.
And they should go to universities and encourage young physicists or engineers to follow this field because there's a good career path in it.
Yeah.
I think in Europe they may be doing a better job. When I visited ISAI in Finland, that place was loaded with young engineers from all over Europe, so many different countries. It was very invigorating to be around them. And maybe we need to recruit some people overseas and not just from the United States if we don't have enough.
Well, thank you very much for your insights, Tom. It was amazing having a conversation with you. Even your book is still as popular as ever. And I'm glad to see you teaching what you know to others. I think that's obviously the bigger thing we need to fill right now, not just the technology understanding, but just to bring more people to understanding the value of this and participating in it.
Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me to speak to you today. I appreciate what you're doing with Project Geospatial.
Now, thank you everyone for watching. I'm Adam Simmons of Project Geospatial. We'll talk to everybody next time.